I do not, for one, think that the problem was that the band was down. I think that the problem may have been that there was a Stonehenge monument on the stage that was in danger of being crushed by a dwarf. All right? That tended to understate the hugeness of the object.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Look, see? Still got the old Tagger on it. See? Never even played it. See?
You just bought it?
Don't touch it. Don't touch it.
I wasn't going to touch it.
No,
I was just pointing at it.
Well, don't point even.
Don't even point?
No. It can't be played. Never. I mean,
Can I look at it?
No. No, you've seen enough of that one.
You do a remarkable job, as we've sort of gone over here, of tracing sort of the trials and tribulations of the industry, I guess you could say, of the talking board and the makers and stuff. And you say that the talking board industry saw renewed interest in the 1940s. So I guess talk a little bit about what spawned that and maybe backtrack us a little bit to, you know, we've established here that it was booming in around the 1920s or something like that. What happened? Did it sort of dip down with the Depression and everything and then come back, you know, after the war? What's the ebb and flow of the popularity here on that?
So what happens is we have the initial takeoff of like the 1890s, 1900s, mm-hmm. and then 1920s, 1940s, 1960s, and then today. And what always happens to the Ouija board is a couple of factors that happen. So wartime always makes the Ouija board do well. And early days, it would be because we didn't have, or we can attribute some of it to, people would use the Ouija board to get answers about their sons that were overseas. And there were no telephones, and you barely got letters, and they took forever. And so getting answers on your loved ones was huge. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that happens is economic downturn. So when people lose their jobs, people start to want answers, and they want to have they turn toward a more spiritual way. Things get simpler because you have less, and people start wanting to know what's going to happen. So, you know, you have those times like the 1920s, you get, you know, World War I, World War II, and 1960s, you know, you've got the Vietnam War. And, in 1967, the Ouija board did something no other game has ever done before or since, and it sold more copies than Monopoly.
Oh, wow.
So, it's just, you know, it's huge. It was just like, oh my gosh. And, that's just kind of, you know, again, an amazing thing. So, again, every generation discovers the Ouija board. And it's kind of theirs. And now, you know, it's in every B-movie in the world, and people use it all the time, you know, for fun, whether they're joking or not. But, you know, there's Hasbro's actually made a deal with Universal and Michael Bay to make the official Ouija movie.
Oh, wow.
So, I'll be consulting on that too, which is kind of neat.
Nice.
And yeah, we'll see how that goes. You know, like it's gonna be hard to top the 1980s, you know, Witch Board movie, which is, you know, it's horrible and it's campy, but it's so perfect. You know, it's like the first movie where the whole movie was about Ouija board use.
Yeah, sometimes those are the best movies though, so.
Oh yeah, well, look, the scariest thing about Witch Boards is the 80s haircuts. But pretty campy.
Now, did the popularity take a hit from, you know, these outside sources of entertainment like television and movies and stuff like that? Obviously, you know, that spawned interest the way you're talking about now. But also, it would seem like nowadays, no one plays board games anymore, it seems. Obviously, Ouija has made the transition to iPhone apps and all kinds of other stuff like that. So, you know, it transcends that possibly. But I presume also, you know, that the days of people playing board games and stuff are waning, and maybe at times it also took a hit on the Ouija board, I presume, but maybe not.
Yeah, you know, like, because it the Ouija board life kind of grows in spurts and usually through fads, it did. But strangely, again, board games always do well during times of war. And if you watch television, you will see Hasbro do these family game nights, and they sell a boatload of these games because, again, people don't have a lot of money. And so you start getting kind of get back to basics. And that's cyclical, right? You know, like economic downturns happen all the time. At least once a generation, everyone hits, you know, hopefully, thankfully, not as bad as, you know, the Great Depression. But yeah, it does. And a big worry for me, often spent many times thinking about, God, in this world of like, you know, Nintendo and Wii and Xbox, who's going to play with a Ouija board? You know, how is that really going to work out? And strangely, it found its way into the iPhone apps and iPad apps. And And now, for the first time, I will say, and I think this from my research, usually the Ouija board, when as it gets popular, spawns interest in the world of paranormal. But this time, I think it was different. I think it was all the kind of reality or ghost hunting shows, you know, that people were starting to use Ouija boards, and then it caught on, and now all of a sudden they're selling like crazy. You know, Hasbro did an exclusive with Toys R Us, where they made a pink Ouija board.
Oh wow!
And they made it kind of like called the Barbie or the My Little Pony one, and it came with this carrying case, a little kind of purse for girls, and it sold like mad. And it took over a year before Fox News, it hit the front page of Fox News. Like, you know, the right-wing evangelicals were just horrified. And they're like, oh, my God, Hasbro is entrapping and ensnaring young girls' souls by this. And it's like, you know, Ouija boards have been sold for 100 years. They're marketing towards little kids. It's no different than their, you know, the other edition, it glows in the dark. No, really? So it's kind of like, it's funny to me. It passed, and the exclusive passed. But actually, Ozzy Osbourne is offering a Aussie version with Hasbro of the Ouija board for if you buy their like exclusive or like the better tickets. I think they're like $333 and for the tickets, and you get one of his Ouija boards. That's a real official Ouija board, but it's all themed for him. So
that's cool.
If you like the Prince of Darkness, you can pick up his
Now, have you worked with Hasbro at all, like with your research and you know, in any, even if it's just like in a consultation role or anything like that? I mean, have they been in touch with you?
Yes, absolutely. I talk with them quite a bit. They're great, great, great. You know, they're selling a game and a product, and they were very interested when I first contacted them a few years ago about it. When I read, it was, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago now that they had announced that they were going to do it, actually saw an interview or was reading an interview online about 1 o'clock in the morning with the CEO of Hasbro. And he was new, and Brian Goldner, and he was excited, and he saw potential in Ouija board. He basically was saying, you know, this is an untapped market. It's a brand that everyone recognizes, and I think this is really valuable. We could do a great job. And we're going to do this movie. And I immediately wrote him and was just like, you know, hey, I'm really impressed that you did this. This is my background on the Ouija board. I'd love to get involved in this project and to kind of talk to you about its history. And it was really funny. You know, he's on the West Coast, and I wrote it at 1 o'clock in the morning. When I got up at 6 o'clock in the morning, he had already written me back and put me in touch with the people who are heading the movie project. So they've been fantastic to me. I've been out So Ouija boards are also still made in the United States, whereas many of their games are made overseas. It's still made in Longmeadow near Springfield, Massachusetts.
Oh, wow.
So, though it was made, you know, one time it was made in Baltimore, it was made in Salem, Massachusetts. Since I want to say 1992, it's been made in Longmeadow, Massachusetts. So it still is.
Now, have you, I presume, obviously, that you've used the Ouija board. How often do you use it? I mean, is it sort of like, now is it sort of like you, like with me, it's like I don't listen to much paranormal radio because I work in paranormal radio. So it's like, you know, I need to take a break and watch SportsCenter or something. Is it sort of like that with you where it's like, listen, I don't want to play with a Ouija board. My life is Ouija boards. Mm-hmm. Or do you find yourself using them more often than not?
Well, no, I'm definitely completely obsessed with them for sure. But no, I don't use them very much. I never really have. I have used them. I find it fascinating, but kind of get into it more in investigating its history and as doing other people. The one thing I did find real early on that it was kind of like a red flag for me was Ouija boards are so polarizing, and people who use them have such strong opinions that I knew if I wanted to stay objective, I kind of needed to not do that because it was easy to go full into the real, well, are they good? Are they bad?
Yeah.
That's kind of crazy. It's like the argument with guns. You know, people have this a problem with guns, and I was born in Maine and have family and spent much of my life on a farm or my early life. And, you know, I am a super liberal Democrat, I will say, and I know it upsets my other liberal friends, but like guns don't kill people. People kill people. And, you know, it's the same thing with the Ouija board. Like, Ouija boards are not killing anybody. You know, like there are stories early on from the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s. One of the great story was the Ouija board told me to kill my daddy, so I did. And this young girl took a gun, a shotgun, and she killed her father. And it turns out what comes out in the trial was her mother was having an affair with what they were calling a cowboy, and her husband was in the Navy, and she didn't want to get a divorce because she would not have any money. So she played the Ouija board with her daughter, and she decided to use the Ouija board to tell the daughter that she needed to kill her father. So she was pushing it, the mother was pushing it, and, oh, you need to kill him for your mother, you need to do this. And she, the little girl believed she was talking to spirits.
Hmm.
It turns out it was her mother. So she went and did it. And the mother, the daughter ended up in an asylum. The mother ended up going to jail as well, but it was overturned later on because he couldn't really prove she did it. So it's kind of, you know, bizarre. There's tons of these bizarre stories throughout time.
Yeah, that's weird. Jeez.
Yeah, it's really weird. But, I mean, again, it's people. I guess the point of the story is, you know, Ouija boards don't do this, just like guns don't. I mean, okay, granted, I don't think maybe the average person needs, you know, an Uzi or semi-automatic weapon.
Yeah.
I don't really find much support in that, but I don't, it's not the actual weapon. It's what people do with those weapons. And so it's the same thing with a Ouija board. It's a tool, and I do believe that if you don't know what you're doing and you're just kind of being stupid about it and you're being, you know, mean or aggressive, yeah, you're probably not going to have a good experience. And the neat thing about, again, we always put Ouija boards separate, but you think about it this way. The Ouija board is most people's first experience in the paranormal. And like many other things that are we have first experiences, it's not that great. It's like, you know, the first time you have sex, you don't know what you're doing. It doesn't last very long. It's awkward and you're scared and it's not your best performance. And so what happens with a Ouija board is people do it once or twice, have a bad experience, and then they're just like, never do this again. And they get rid of their Ouija board. You know, luckily in sex, we keep trying and practicing until we make it perfect. So doesn't, unfortunately for Ouija boards, they try them a couple times, they end up in the closet. But, you know, I often say, like, Ouija boards, it's funny because the industry, the, like, kind of ghost investigating industry is starting to re-embrace Ouija boards. People who said they'd never sell them are selling them. The shows are showing Ouija board use. People are not, it's like it's turning. The tide is turning towards them. And I love to see that. It's fantastic to see people kind of looking at it more objectively than just what someone told them about it. But, it's just kind of interesting to me because Ouija boards are much like the gateway drug. It's kind of like marijuana. It's where people who get into drugs start. And for the paranormal, it's where it starts. You know, most of us and all these people who investigate ghosts, their first experiences with the Ouija board, and now they're like, should never use those. That's what invites, you know, evil in. I just think it's funny. You know, it's like, yeah, but, you know, having a seance and walking around a room telling a ghost, you know, I want you to hit me, I want you to do this. It's like, well, wait a minute. How are you putting yourself in danger more over here than you are over here?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Because you hear these stories about people, like you just said, challenging ghosts and stuff like that. That sounds a lot more dangerous or you know, malevolent than playing with a Ouija board.
Right, where you're just like, hey, is anybody there? As opposed to, you know, calling it names and trying to get a rise out of it. It's like,
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying it's wrong. It also makes great television. Don't get me wrong. I love all those shows, and I love, you know, I've watched the Ghost Hunters forever, worked with them. They're fantastic. Paranormal State, you know, the Ghost Adventurers, great guys, you know, all have their own thing going on. And it's funny, as I've worked with them over the years, all these different groups, it's changed. You know, one time I was doing in Cooperstown, I want to say it was Cooperstown in January of 2010, I got Hasbro to give me, a bunch of Ouija boards. And we went and I did my kind of lecture, and then asked the Ghost Hunters, hey, I want to give away all these Ouija boards, and I want people to use them during their investigations. And they were just like, oh my God, we're totally against them, we don't ever want them. And I said to them, I think if you would see if you just let me do this, you know, at first people are like, oh, there's no way we want them. And then after I do the lecture and I go through the history, like everyone wanted one.
Yeah.
And then it was the best. You saw people running around from room to room in this hotel in Cooperstown with their Ouija board under their arm. You know, and like we had like, you know, Jason and Grant were, they were laughing their butts off. It was like, oh my God. And you know, I was trying to show them, look, what really, what's the difference between, you've got them using all of these tools. They're all trying to make contact. What is the difference? And you know, same thing, you know, the Ghost Adventures are great. I mean, you know, they've been, you know, kind of using Ouija boards and different things from the beginning. They were super open to it. You know, I went up with them in Mansfield. Fantastic group of people.
Yeah, well, I'm sure there's also, you know, a desire, I guess you could say, on the part of some ghost hunting groups and stuff to be scientific. You know what I mean? And so in turn, then they shun the Ouija board because that's antiquated, if you will. Do you know what I mean? Kind of goes back to what you're saying about technology.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's kind of neat. You have a, like Bill Chappell who's done all these great things like the Ovilus. You know, I mean, they're just, you know, to me, they're like electronic Ouija boards. So it's just funny, you know, to see how everything comes. But yeah, you know, and then you've got, you know, different people who want to try, you know, to me, the most fascinating experiment would be to really use all of what we consider the latest devices with a Ouija board. Like seeing, okay, if you're making contact with the Ouija board, is it showing, are there any electromagnetic fields? Are there any EVPs at the same time? You know, which thing is working and is it getting picked up across the board? So
yeah,
that's kind of, those would be neat to see. I'd love to see more of that.
All right. Now here's a story that someone posted on my forum about the production of the Ouija boards. And I'll see if you've heard this story or if there's anything to it. Clendenin said he knew a guy that worked in the toy industry in Cincinnati at Kenner. And he said that he heard a lot of secret stuff from the toy industry. And he sort of laughed at him saying, you know, what kind of secret stuff could you hear? And he told him this story about the Ouija board. And it said, let me find the right part here. It says, anyway, somewhere in the company's past, they made Ouija boards competing with the likes of Parker Brothers and Milton Bradley and various others. So this might have been like a Ouija knockoff or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
He says, and I'll send this to you after the interview so you can, you know, investigate it or put it in your files or whatever. But he says, he told me in the early 1950s, there were long-held rumors that if you burned a Ouija board that had made true contact, the thing would sparkle, fizzle, and turn all sorts of colors, etc., like demons were being let out. It was the rumor, and I'm sure it traveled, as most rumors do, of that sort amongst kids and such. Anyway, keep in mind this is before the safety and liability issues of today, back when we coated things in lead paint. They decided to use this rumor to propel their sales, and they started telling people their boards worked better. They actually found an accelerant of the type 4th of July sparklers are coated with, altered with a few chemicals to make it change colors while burning, and put it into the board. The boards were stock made of compressed fiberboard, so adding an accelerant into the fireboard during manufacture was a simple process. Not enough to explode, mind you, but definitely a fire hazard, and enough to make it appear to be much more than a regular burning board. The next thing they did was to use this board in every fourth game. 1 in 4 used this board, so that not every time, but sometimes when burned, the thing would be pretty spectacular and appear to match the rumor. I doubted him honestly until he produced some of the stock they still had. Use was discontinued in the early 60s. He broke off a piece. We set it on fire. It was actually pretty cool to see, but would definitely appear to make you go, if you didn't expect it. So what do you think of that? Have you ever heard this story before, or is this something new?
No, you know, it's definitely something new to me. And the reason being is Kenner became part of Kenner Parker Toys. And so Kenner Parker and Parker Brothers, again, made the Ouija board. So I've never heard of Kenner before they merged making it, but it wouldn't surprise me because many of the other major manufacturers did have knockoff boards. But
yeah,
I've never heard of it, but that's, you know, I'd love for you to send me that because those are some of the stories that turn out to be true or sometimes they're just kind of stories that are passed on, but that's pretty neat.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty weird. He says, Kenner started in 47, was bought by General Mills, thanks Wiki, which added Play-Doh to their lineup, which was then bought by Tonka, then Hasbro. So I don't know the chronology.
That's absolutely right, because General Mills bought Parker Brothers, and then they combined. They had Kenner toys and Parker toys, and Parker Brothers. So they merged them to become Kenner Parker toys, and then Parker Brothers again then broke off.
Yeah. So have you ever heard any stories, not necessarily about them doing, about them, you know, coating the boards with things, but of people who burned their boards and crazy stuff happened that we could actually attribute to this story?
People will say, you know, again, that they try to burn it, it doesn't burn. You know, they have to keep lighting it on fire, it won't burn. And I always kind of, you know, scientifically put that to, yeah, I mean, that compressed fiberboard or masonite or press board, I mean, back then, like that article said, or that letter said, that they didn't use great things. I mean, yeah. Who knows what was in that crap? You know what I mean? Like, there was no, like, regulations on what you could, you know, putting different preservatives in wood. And
yeah, it could be asbestos for all we know.
Exactly. You know, I have some early boards that glow, that used to glow in the dark from the 20s and 40s that, who knows what the hell they use to make those things glow.
Yeah,
I'm sure it definitely would not pass the safety standard test, you know, today as to what they make things glow. So it always makes me laugh. It's like, oh my gosh, you know.
Yeah, I'll send you the post here in this guy's contact info. Maybe you can get some more info on what he's talking about. I thought that was a pretty weird story. Now, what have you must have heard of this story of Emily Grant Hutchins and the Mark Twain book. What do you think of that whole thing?
Yeah, you know, many things. There's, before that, there was, Pearl Kern, and there are many stories which, again, propel Ouija board use, and that's, you know, the belief that someone is using a Ouija board to, you know, kind of funnel someone famous or another spirit and write. And, you know, again, you just touched upon another one, you know, actually getting, you know, Mark Twain to come through and write novels. And the thing is there's never any proof anyway. And then you'll have literary people go through and say, oh, it is him. No, it's not his style at all. It's like, you know, I can't imagine writing a book through a Ouija board.
Yeah.
You know how long that would take? I mean, my God, the patience you would have to have to spell out every word letter by letter. But they did it. And, you know, actually, there were quite a few people who did, you know, quite a few books and hundreds of pages of prose and poetry.
Oh, really? Wow.
You know, so, and there's actually, there is a great book. I can't believe I'm not going to remember the two sisters who wrote this book. Hopefully it comes to me. But it's called The Book of Inspiration. And it's actually, God, I hope the names of them come to me. They wrote a book, and the whole message was supposedly given to them through their spirit guide and through a Ouija board. So it's still today, the same thing is happening.
Now, do you think that the Ouija board's always going to be sort of stuck with this cultural baggage of it being occult and sinister now that it's become, you know, I mean, this has been going on for a couple generations now, at least, that sort of idea that it's dangerous and all this other stuff. You think it'll ever shake that off, or it's going to always sort of have on it?
I think we'll always have it. You know, we live in a world of, like, instant media, right? So, like, we have cable news, like, telling us every time someone crosses the street when they're not supposed to. And so you think about what makes, like, Fox News, right? You know, Fox, the only thing that makes Fox News, it's never anything good. It's always the most outrageous, horrible, horrifying story.
Yeah.
And so with Ouija boards, you know, for every story that someone finds something that was, they'd lost their ring and the Ouija board told them where to go, it's not going to make the news. You know, what makes the news is the Ouija board told someone to kill their family, you know, and they do. And
yeah.
That's going to make the news. And so whatever makes the news is what we hear and sticks in our head. So, no, every time something bad happens that has to do with the Ouija board, it's going to make the news, and that's going to reinforce the fact that they're bad. But, you know, like everything else, the minute the church or your parents tell you not to do something, it's the first thing you're going to do. So it's never going to hurt Ouija boards, because the minute that, you know, like, it's like when The Exorcist came out, the movie, I mean, every person who, you know, there were people passing out in the movie theater, they were screaming, they were trampling, trying to get out. And you know what they did? They went home, because and bought a Ouija board because everyone wanted to see their friend's head spin around and spit up, you know, split pea soup. So it's what sells Ouija boards, or every time one of these movies that really scares the crap out of someone comes out, more Ouija boards get sold because everyone wants to experience it.
Yeah, yeah, that definitely seems to be the case. The sisters are Tina and Tilda Fiori.
Yeah.
There you go. That way you don't, you know, you're not going to have that.
I would think about that all night long, and they'd kill me. They're such nice, nice women, and they worked really hard on that book. It's a great, fascinating book, too. You know, and they did a great job. But it was just neat to see, you know, another book after all this time being, you know, written and, you know, through the Ouija board.
Now, what kind of feedback do you generally get? Are most people, you know, positive about what you're doing, or do you get a lot of people warning you, like, that, you know, you're messing with the devil and stuff like that?
You know, when I first started doing this, Ed and Lorraine Warren were, like, immediately contacted me when I was collecting and just told me I was, you know, just crazy and that I was inviting this. And, you know, again, all these years later, nothing bad's ever happened. You know, the doorway to hell has never opened in my house. And I, like I told them all those years ago, if and when it does, I promise I will sell you a ticket. It hasn't happened for me. I'm not saying it won't and it couldn't, and it's just it hasn't. I usually get, I've never gotten anyone being rude or mean. I've gotten people who are genuinely concerned for my soul. And, you know, look, hell, if anyone's genuinely concerned about me, I'm all for, like, them. You know, hey, okay, I might not agree, but, you know, they're actually really trying to warn me about something. That's fine. And most people just tend to be open-minded about it. And, you know, when you research something a lot and you've shown yourself to be, you know, valid and correct about your research, people tend to treat you differently. I think I appreciate the fact that trying to get the facts straight has earned me, you know, a good reputation. So even though people might disagree, you know, when we talk history and debate the facts, it doesn't always equal where they're going with it. And so I've never really had a problem. You know, I have some good friends in the industry who fall clearly on the other side of the fence on this, but, you know, they've always been very respectful.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of it too with the Ouija board is, and you know, I'm a, I guess you could say I'm sort of an agnostic skeptic or something along those lines, or I'm an open-minded skeptic. So I've never used a Ouija board. So, although after this interview, you know, you're making me want to use a Ouija board. And I've had other guests on the show who are like, don't go there, man. Don't even go there. So it's like, now I'm getting conflicting messages here. But, I think if it really is truly, you know, a gateway to the other side, I think a lot has to do with the energy that you bring to it anyway. And I mean, you have this like love for the Ouija board. So I can't imagine why, you know, I think what you put out comes back to you in a way. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Totally, I totally agree with you. Especially when you're dealing with something that has to do with, you know, whether it's psychic energy or, you know, your ability to contact the other side. I think what you take with you and what you bring with it, it definitely, you go into it with a bad attitude or being scared, and I guarantee you it's not going to be a great experience.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. If you're like, oh, you know, I'm afraid to use this because a demon might come through, then, you know, that they know that, I think. I think that, yeah. You know, it gets projected out there, and it's like, oh, shit, you know, here comes demons, man.
Exactly. They're just like, cool, someone wants to talk to demons. Awesome, you know. Like, you know, and so, yeah, I do. I totally agree with you. And I also think, you know, the other problem is when you're dealing with stuff like this and, you know, you believe you can talk to demons and that they can do really bad stuff to you, you have to be very strong. You know, no doubt. And I think, unfortunately, people's first experience of the Ouija board, you know, they're giggling and it's funny and it's cool and it's neat. And, you know, yeah, if you can get yourself into trouble, I think, if you're really looking to. And, you know, I've had some really cool discussions with people about, you know, some people, they do rituals or things to kind of cleanse the board, or say a prayer, or picture a white light. And I tell everyone when they ask me what should they do, you should do whatever you have to do to make yourself feel confident about that you're in charge and you're deciding when you start talking and you decide when it's over. And
yeah.
You know, whatever that takes. For some people, it's, you know, it's using salt and saying prayers, and other people, it's just saying, you know, hey, I'm large and in charge, and you're not going to do anything bad to me.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Now, I'm sure you've probably sort of gotten this question before, but it's like, I guess, as I sort of said to you, you know, here I am, I'm sort of an agnostic skeptic or an open-minded skeptic about all this sort of stuff. I think that gives me the best position to look at all these different paranormal subjects, so I'm not just like a true believer on stuff. Right. But what's your take on the Ouija in general? Do you really think it is sort of, you know, this communication device with the other side?
Well, I think it can be. You know, I have, like I said, I've seen it be a communication to just people's subconscious, and then I've seen things I can't explain. And so I have to believe that if spirits or the other side can make contact, then of course they can do it through a Ouija board. But, you know, that's the whole thing is we're never really going to know until we're on that other side, I guess.
Yeah.
And that's what makes the whole hunt fascinating.
Absolutely, yeah. That's what, you know, that's the journey we're all on, you know, the
exactly.
guests and me and everybody else, you know, we're all trying to figure out what the hell's going on here with these mysteries.
Right, exactly. And the Ouija board plays a fun part in our pop culture, for sure.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's remarkable, too, because the paranormal seems to ebb and flow and wane, and as you've sort of said, you know, the Ouija board is this iconic piece of paranormalia, if you will, for lack of a better term, that has lasted all those years, you know, over 100 years. It's a remarkable piece of equipment, and it's just such a simple piece of equipment too. It's really quite. I can understand your fascination and obsession with it. The more we talk about it, the more, you know, you think about it. It's quite remarkable that this thing has captured the imaginations of people for over 100 years.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, it was. Yeah, it's just crazy. It was, you know, it turned 120 last year, so.
Wow.
That's pretty cool.
Now, is it still really huge in, like, Europe and Canada and stuff? I mean, is this still a worldwide phenomenon, or is it really more something that's, like, Americana?
It always is pretty good. I think it's biggest in America. You know, Canada probably second, because they're majorly influenced by the same things and see the same TV shows as the United States. But in Europe, it still is. You know, if you go online or go on eBay and you see, there's tons of different kind of knockoff Ouija boards that are still being made and different talking boards.
Now, we sort of talked about this earlier, and you just mentioned it, and I had this question sort of like you know, in the back of my mind here. I wanted to make sure that I got to it. What sort of like constitutes a knockoff of the Ouija board? Was it, you know, is it the layout of the letters and everything, or is it just all the different stuff in the corners? You know, like if I wanted to make a fake or a knockoff Ouija board, you know, what would you just like slap different symbols in the corners and that counts and you're okay, you're not going to get sued, that kind of thing?
Yeah. So basically all that's left for the Ouija board is kind of a copyright on how it looks, and meaning like not necessarily layout of letters, but the symbols that are on it. And the trademark itself, the word Ouija.
Yeah.
So you can use the same layout, you know, the same two arcing letters and the numbers kind of in a straight line. And you can use, you know, a sun and a moon, but they can't look the same. And if you put people playing it in the corners and you use the sun and the moon, you're asking to get in trouble. You know, there was a few iPod or an iPhone and iPad apps that the design looked strikingly similar, like someone scanned it in, and quickly those apps had been removed from the App Store. So I think you get into trouble as you try to make an exact copy, but it's easy to get around it because, you know, you can use the same symbols, you just use different, you do the arcing, but you can kind of, you know, use different symbols, so it gets pretty, I think, easy and quick to get around.
Yeah.
Not calling it a Ouija board.
Yeah, just don't call it, yeah, just don't say, like, it's the merch brand Ouija board.
Exactly.
As you've established here, clearly in this conversation, you're all about the Ouija board. What's next for you? Obviously, you're helping out with this movie, and I see on your website that you're working with Eugene Orlando from the Museum of Talking Boards to co-write the ultimate book on the history of the Ouija board. So, you know, what's next for you? What do you have going on?
Yeah, you know, it's just the research never ends. There's always something new. Every time I think we're done, something new pops up. So, you know, I do kind of a lot of conventions. I think my next one is going to be, I just got contacted by the folks over in Paranormal State, so I think there's something at Penn State February 26th that I'll be involved in, and then I'm going to be doing the, I always say this wrong, but it's in Gettysburg, and it's phenomenal. Oh, it's, I can't say it. Tonight, my mouth is just not going to do it right, but there's like March 26th, I think. All in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania is another fantastic conference. So, yeah, I do a lot of conferences and travel around and lecture and talk about it and kind of bring my mini display of Ouija boards out there and show people, and so you get to see kind of how the Ouija board has changed and how it often reflects the times that it was made in. So,
and how do you mean by that, how it reflects the times it was made in?
Well, they change the symbols and things for these other Ouija boards, including the regular Ouija board, based on when it comes from. So you see things in the 1920s when, like originally the Ouija board was called the Egyptian luck board.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's like, well, why? What the hell did that have to do with it? Well, in 1890, there were a lot of discoveries in the Valley of the Kings on Egypt. So to Americans, Egypt was, you know, a completely occult place in their minds. So tying it to that, so you in the 1920s they were making other boards, and you would start to see like the Sphinx and little pharaohs and different boards. Hasco made a fantastic mystic board, and it's all Egyptian themed. And then, you know, you get into like the 1940s when things were getting really big. Swamis were getting really big, so you see a lot of that. And then, you know, by the 60s, horoscopes and 70s were really big, and so you start to see a lot of horoscopes getting added to the symbols and used on the board. So it's kind of neat. They often reflect whatever else was really big.
Yeah, that's interesting. Genre. Then you see in contemporary times, you know, they're making the Barbie ones and everything else.
Glow in the dark, exactly. And yeah, I put them all over my wall, so I will tell you, they're great conversation pieces, and they make wonderful artwork.
Yeah, they are pretty cool. I think I might have to go out and get a Ouija board after this conversation so I can, if not play with it, have one around, you know, because they are pretty cool. So I've enjoyed the conversation quite a bit. We've teased here the book. Do we have any sort of timetable on when people can expect to get their hands on a copy of, you know, the definitive history of the Ouija board?
I wish. on it, you know, for a while, and unfortunately the research always ends up, you know, we need to look at this, and then we do, and that takes us off into a totally another direction. So yeah, it will definitely be done in my lifetime. I will finish this from this side of the veil. So
well, there you go. Yeah,
at least I hope to.
Well, if not, then it has the extra added appeal of being, you know, co-written via the Ouija. So
exactly. Wouldn't that be fantastic? Talk about ghostwriting, right? That would be great.
Exactly. Well, Merch, I got to say, I've had an amazing time talking to you, and you know, your passion for this subject is really infectious. I mean, you really just – it's just great to listen to and you know, great to take part in and participate in this conversation. So, you know, hopefully folks out there learned about the history of the Ouija here and got a different point of view on it. And that, I think, is really important to come out of this conversation, too, that they've heard a lot of horror stories about the Ouija board, especially if they're in the paranormal community. But, you know, it's time to take a step back and take a rational look at this and realize that, you know, what you bring to the table is a large part what you get out of it, too. So, you know, it's not the Ouija board, folks. It's you. It's you that's conjuring all this stuff. And like I said, you know, your passion for the subject is really something to behold. And I wish you the best of luck. It's been great talking to you. We'll definitely talk to you again in the future. You're only, you know, a stone's throw from where I am. So hopefully, you know, we can get together sometime and grab a beer and talk more about this stuff and the paranormal community, you know, at length.
I would love that. And thank you so much for having me on and the patience on, you know, the many reschedules that it took us to get here.
But, don't even worry about it.
I'm glad we did, and it's a pleasure. Anytime, you know, I'm happy to come on, and I'm always good for a beer, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Nice. Like to hear that. That does it for this week's edition of BOA Audio Season 6. Big, big thanks to Robert Merch for coming on the show. Be sure to check out his website, www.robertmurch.com, robertmurch.com, as well as williamfuld.com, and you spell Fuld, F-U-L-D.
Links are all over BOA. Be sure to check out the websites. Lots of cool information there on the Ouija board. Moving right along now, it's time for BOA Audio listener feedback, and we got a couple of short ones this week and a long one as well, so let's just dive right in. First one comes from Kirk, no hometown listed. Here's what he has to say. I heard your interview with Dr. Curran. If you want to try your hand at cracking the Voynich manuscript, Wikipedia has got JPEGs of the whole thing. Peace out, Kirk. Well, thank you for the heads up, Kirk. Solving a mystery of sorts that we had on the program last week. So if folks want to check out more about the Voynich manuscript, punch it into Wikipedia and they've got some JPEGs of it. I will definitely be heading over there to take a look. Next email comes from Thomas, no hometown listed. Here's what he has to say. Only two shows in around 2 months. Are we looking at game over, Tim? I know you've said otherwise. As they say in England, the proof is on the pudding. And that comes from Thomas, no hometown listed. I don't even know what to say there. First of all, I can't apologize any more than I have in the past few installments of the program for the delays that have been going on here at BOA HQ the last few weeks. We're very close to getting things back up and running. And again, thanks to all the folks who've been sending us very supportive emails. As I said to Thomas, who actually posted this on my Facebook page today, of all days, when I'm putting together the latest edition of BOA Audio. Child, please, BOA is not going anywhere. We've got a bunch of great episodes in the pipeline, and things seem to be rolling along a lot smoother than they had in the last month or so. I know you may be skeptical hearing that from me right now, but trust me, as Thomas likes to say, the proof is on the pudding, and I will put the proof on the pudding by putting out more BOA Audio at a faster rate than we have the last few weeks. Thank you for your amusing post, Thomas. No worries, BOA is not going anywhere. Just a bump in the road. The final email this week comes from Jim in Dearborn, Michigan, and here's what he has to say. Just a quick note of support and thanks for one of the few podcasts that has survived my discerning audio palate. You are consistently interesting and well-researched, with a diverse array of guests and a genuine drive for knowledge that makes your show a pleasure to listen to. For my part, here are a couple things not to sweat. Time between show posts. Your recent longer intervals between posts has given me time to listen more than once. I have listened to Bix Weir 3 times, Phil and Brogno 2 times, and I'm starting in on Dr. Bob Curran for the 2nd time. Because you're so well prepared and so interested in your guests, your shows are very dense with information and bear multiple listens very well. Swearing. You swear, on air at least, for emphasis or as casual interjection. Not at all uncommon among friends and associates at this period in history. Your show is, as often as not, more like a recorded conversation than a formal interview, which is one of the attractive things about it. So the swearing is not at all out of place. People who swear excessively create the impression that they lack the ability to express themselves more precisely or intelligently. You are definitely not in that category, and your sliding age scale of appropriate use of swears was brilliant. Anyway, next time I get to Massachusetts, I'm totally buying you some beers. Keep up the good work. You're awesome, etc. Jim in Dearborn, Michigan. Thank you for writing in, Jim. Much appreciated. Really am speechless about the kind things you've had to say. This sort of email here, like the one from Jim, is an example of the really awesome support we've gotten from the folks out there who are BOA Audio hardcore listeners who are really seriously supporting the program. I really am just so appreciative of that. I know it's been a very difficult stretch here for the show the last 6 weeks or so, and I kind of joked about it there with Thomas, but trust me, I am taking this very, very seriously, and we are supremely focused on BOA Audio right now. I know it doesn't look that way when you look at the posting times between episodes, but trust me, we've got a lot going on the cooker here at the BOA kitchen, and definitely on the back burner as well. You'll be hearing about some of these killer episodes as we keep going here in Season 6, but we are really trying to find some of the most compelling researchers to feature here on the program week after week. I could bust out the Rolodex and just start going down the list of people who've been on the show before and have them back on the program and pump out show after show after show, but I want to really do something special here, and that is to take the exploration where it leads me, and that's what this season is all about. Thank you also, Jim, for voicing your support on the swearing. A very thoughtful and measured analysis of the swearing on the program. I think he definitely gets it and gets the point I've been trying to make here at the end of the show. BOA Audio is less an interview and definitely more a conversation, and as such, the more the guest and I let our guards down, the more likely it is you're going to hear some inadvertent swearing. And of course, we never aim to upset or offend our listeners. Finally, Jim, let me know next time you're in Massachusetts. I am definitely down for getting some beers. That does it for BOA Audio listener feedback this week. Thanks to Jim for his supportive email. Thanks to Thomas for his hilarious kick in the ass about the delays. And thanks to Kirk for the info on the Voynich manuscript. If you'd like to be a part of BOA Audio listener feedback in the future, here's how you can do it. Just write to boaaudio@hotmail.com or go to binallofamerica.com, B-I-N-N-A-L-L of America.com, and click the contact button. And of course, the final method is to join up at the official BOA forum, the usofe.com, T-H-E-U-S-O-F-E.com. It is BOA's paranormal playground. We're getting ready to kick off the baseball discussion once again this year, and it is going to be a wild ride, I'm sure. So head on over to the usofe.com for all your paranormal and pop culture discussion needs. And, of course, I'm on Facebook and Twitter, so follow me or poke me. It's all good, and I would love to make a connection with you on one of those sites as well. Up next, let's do the thanks portion of the program. Allow me to roll through the list of the esteemed and infamous BOA staff. Leslie, Chiron, Regan Lee, Joe V, Tina Senna, Rochelle Hawks, Richard Thomas, Marla Pena, Bruce Pretty, and our newest columnist, Tony Morrill, who debuted this past week at BOA. I'll talk a little bit more about Tony Morrill in just a moment. Also, of course, big thanks to our contributing cartoonist, Andy Carolin, and our webmaster, Jeremy Boston. Tony just debuted this week with his new column, Fortean Ramblings. This time around, it is his first piece titled Origin Story, or The Answer is 42. And he tells people who he is and how he ended up writing for Binall of America. Welcome to the team, Tony. It's great to have you on the BOA staff. But what about the veterans? What about the hardcore writers for BOA who have contributed since the last edition of BOA Audio? Let me tell you a little bit about their stuff. Leslie talks about her visit to the Las Lunas Inscription Rock in New Mexico. Very fascinating regional esoterica there. Regan Lee looks at the animal die-offs trend and how it ties into the Fortean conspiracy matrix. Mind-blowing stuff from Regan Lee. And Marla Pena checks in with Shadow of the Shinigami, looking at some intrigue in the world of Mexican ufology. So, I mean, come on, folks. That's some really interesting and diverse topics covered by the BOA staff. And as we say at the end of the program all the time, if you're only listening to BOA audio and you're not reading the columns at Binall of America, then you're only getting half the story. BOA, make it a part of your everyday search for esoteric news and opinion. Normally, this is the part of the program where I take off my hat and pass it around to the audience and ask you to make a donation to BOA and BOA Audio. But given how lackluster the scheduling has been for BOA Audio Season 6, I don't really feel comfortable going to that well once again here at the end of the program. And in addition to that, this time around, this episode, I think it's important that we stop and think about the people who are really hurting right now. And of course, I'm talking about those folks over in Japan. So if you're thinking about making a BOA donation, don't do it this week. Take your money, send it to the Red Cross or Doctors Without Borders or one of those reputable charitable organizations and help out the folks who need it right now. And that is the people over there in Japan stricken by earthquake, tsunami, and radioactive meltdown. I mean, you can't even wrap your mind around that. At least I can't. That is just a horrific set of circumstances, and it's frightening for those of us in the world of esoterica who have been hearing about situations like this for years to see it unfold before our very eyes. We got to band together now, folks. Who knows what's coming down the road for all of us in the future. That's the perfect segue, though, for the preview for next week's edition of the program. And yes, I said next week's edition of the program. I'm going to work like hell to get this episode out to you guys in 1 week's time. Let's see how well I hold up on that promise. I'm very happy to report it is another knockout edition of the program. Our guest is Stan Gordon. He's the author of the new book, Silent Invasion, which details the UFO Bigfoot wave of 1973-1974 in Pennsylvania. I had never heard this story before, and it is some mind-blowing stuff. In 1973 and in 1974, there was just an amazing wave of UFO and Bigfoot reports in a very concentrated pocket of Pennsylvania. What makes the story even more interesting, what makes the new book by Stan Gordon even more enlightening, is that he's not just telling you the story of what happened. Stan Gordon was there. He was the biggest paranormal researcher in Pennsylvania at the time. He was working hand-in-hand with state and local officials to investigate these cases. He was talking to the witnesses literally hours, if not minutes, after their sightings of UFOs and Bigfoot. So this is some tremendous on-the-ground perspective from somebody who was there as this seriously insane wave of Fortiana was unfolding in Pennsylvania in 1973-1974. We're going to dig all into that with Stan Gordon next week. Very enjoyable conversation, very thought-provoking stuff. And I say that especially in light of our Gian Cassar interview from earlier this season. I'll probably extrapolate more on this in the intro to next week's program. But when you really think about it, the Gian Cassar interview led us down an amazingly strange and enlightening path with regards to the Bigfoot creature. And now enter Stan Gordon's work, which is going to have you looking in a whole nother direction and makes you really wonder what is going on with this enigma. That's next week on the program. Stan Gordon, Silent Invasion, the UFO Bigfoot Wave of 1973-1974 in Pennsylvania. And on that note, we close the book on another edition of BOA Audio Season 6. Thanks once again to Robert Murch for coming on the show. Thanks, of course, to the folks who wrote in for BOA Audio listener feedback. And, obviously, huge, huge thanks to you guys out there, the hardcore BOA Audio listeners, the folks who have stuck with us for so long, week after week, month after month, and year after year. I can't thank you guys enough for your support of this program. It really is what drives the whole operation. Thank you for making BOA Audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist. And on that note, until next time, this is Tim Banal, thanking you for listening and signing off.